Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 705. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris here with another of our conversations analyzing the presidential race for 2016 and bringing back in our good friend and longtime analyst, Colin Delaney, the editor of ePolitics.com. We'll be bringing him in as sort of what I would consider to be almost kind of like a halftime analysis for the primary season. We talked a couple of different times on the show leading up to the start of the primaries. This is our first chance to compare notes, see what we're thinking since the ballots have actually started to be cast. I'd certainly like to catch up with them once and for all, once we know who the nominees are going to be for sure, once we know what the direction of the fall race is going to be. But for the preliminary round, I'd call this sort of the halftime segment, if you will. See where we're at, see what we're thinking about how it's going. And this is certainly a political campaign season like none other. In the FDH Lounge, this is our third cycle of covering presidential races. We started in 2007, and on our first full-length episode that we did at the time, we actually got a jump on covering the 2008 election. If you remember, it started really early in that cycle. We came on the air January 14th, 2007, and the first debates were right around the corner. So we covered the 2008 cycle. We covered 2012, which was really, I think, kind of blah compared to what came before and what has come after. 2016, wow, this is one that we're all going to be telling our grandkids about someday, I'm sure. And somebody who is living it on the front lines, as I say, our longtime friend, somebody who I really enjoy discussing these issues with, Colin Delaney, editor of ePolitics.com. Good to bring him back in, get his thoughts. Colin Delaney, so it's right about halftime, my man, in this preliminary round. How you doing? What's on your mind?
I'm doing okay, Coach. I think we're going to take him in the second half.
Well, depending on which week you're talking about.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you, my man. And depending on what we you're talking about, you have a very good chance of being right. let me start with a partial mea culpa and something I partially got right. And this is something where it's very, very rare that you can find something like that. But my guy, Rand Paul, unfortunately, was out after the first round of votes were cast in Iowa. I said coming in, I liked his chances a little better than some people did because, to me at the time, he was the only guy trying to build a new coalition for this election, something I really didn't see coming and something I'm not even sure Donald Trump saw coming because he seems to fly by the seat of his pants completely, is that he is, in fact, building a new coalition. He is the one guy out there who is really kind of doing things differently. It's sort of a mishmash with some of his ideas, and again, the one chance for this map being a lot different than what we've seen the last couple cycles is if he is the Republican nominee and either gets swamped, like some people had been thinking was going to happen, or if he continues to build this new coalition in the fall against all odds as he has done so far. So to me, from an X's and O's standpoint, if we're going to stay with the sports analogy here for a second, to me, from that technical standpoint, looking at the election, that's been the story so far. How do you see it?
Oh, wow. I mean, I'll tell you, of course, none of us has ever seen anything quite like this. One thing that, you know, I've been fascinated by is the idea that Trump is a candidate of the internet age, but he's a different kind than we've ever seen before, right? Like, if you look at Obama, you look at what Bernie's doing now, you look at what Hillary's doing now, you look at what Ted Cruz is doing now, they're all working the intersection of traditional political organizing and the internet, right? Obama sort of created the modern template of a campaign, and plenty of people on the Republican side were using that just as much as the Democrats are. Trump is a different kind of internet candidate. He's using social media and his own willingness to be a provocateur to kind of program the old media. He's using social media to control television in a way, because everything he says that's over the top or offensive or however you want to judge it, but certainly noteworthy, all of that spreads online, and it just creates more desire among, you know, the cable news bookers, the Sunday morning talk show bookers, to get him on there to take advantage of that. You know, the only thing I can think of is it's going to be Kanye 2020, because I think that this style of candidacy is made for a celebrity and nobody else in a way.
It kind of is, but there's something that I actually see healthy in what he's been able to do, even if a lot of us would agree that it's not healthy. He's been the guy who's been able to exploit it. And again, what's interesting is I come down in the middle of what has been a debate over the course of the last several decades here when you get into what constitutes First Amendment rights in terms of campaign seasons. I don't believe in putting limits on speech and everything
right.
but like that. I don't believe in that kind of regulation. I don't believe in public financing of campaigns. By the same token, I'm very uneasy about it. I'm uneasy about the sway that big money can have in these elections. I don't like it as a citizen, even if I sit here and say, well, my reading of the Constitution doesn't necessarily show there's anything we can do about that. I'm looking at this now. You look at somebody like Mike Murphy with his $100 million in dark money here in the Right to Rise Fund. And let me tell you something. In this election cycle, Mike Murphy didn't have the sway of a college kid sitting in a dorm making memes. Isn't this a good thing? Isn't this sort of a democratization? I mean, I'm not going to be a Pollyanna and say that big money is going to go away overnight. But, you know, what Trump's doing, in a way, it's showing how to level the playing field, isn't it?
Well, and Bernie, too, right? Because
you
know, what has become ironic on the Democratic side is that Bernie is now functionally the big money candidate in terms of resources. Hillary is trying to build a small donor list, and she's having success building it. But Bernie has brought a whole lot of people actively into the financial part of the political process, where Trump hasn't needed it, right? People are just giving him a little bit of money here and there, but he doesn't have a huge campaign infrastructure to support. Now, will that begin to hurt him if any of his opponents hang on, you know, later in the primary process? I don't know. I mean, right now it looks like Rubio is going to get his clock cleaned in Florida, and then that's it for him. And then the Republicans are down to Cruz and Trump, whom, as you know, as we've talked about a lot, nobody in the establishment particularly cares for. But I think you're definitely onto something when you talk about Trump creating a new coalition that could put different states in play, because he is appealing to a lot of union voters, working class white voters, a lot of people who are feeling left behind by the current economy. And that, if that is a positive, you know, if he's bringing attention to the fact that these folks are being left behind, that is a good thing. Unfortunately, what's coming along with it is, you know, this kind of mindless nationalism, verging on and often crossing over into racism. You know, that's driving away a lot of the Republican elite. And not necessarily elites, but people who might just have a college degree or be a doctor or something like that. And, you know, economically, fiscally, and in a lot of their personal values, they may be conservative. But someone like Trump may horrify them enough to drive them. And I'll tell you what, man, I was just reading an article the other day that, you know, a lot of, compared to immigrants from other countries, a lot of Mexicans who get green cards don't actually get citizenship for a long time, where if you're from El Salvador or Guatemala or Ireland or wherever, you tend to get naturalized relatively quickly once you get a green card. But that this year, a lot of Mexican nationals who have green cards are going ahead and becoming American citizens because they want to be able to vote in the November elections. So Trump is creating a new coalition potentially, but it might just be a one-piece coalition that isn't enough to win him the presidency.
It might be. And again, I'm somebody who, again, personally, I am not shy about giving my predictions, my opinions. I kind of thrive on that. I'm putting myself out there and saying, I've been saying to people for a while now, this is uncharted territory. I was saying months ago about the Trump stuff. I don't know, man. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. I don't know how to predict how it's going to shake out. And you mentioned a couple of names there that I'd like to get to. Before we turn our attention to the Democrats, let's, after my very sane choice for President Rand Paul bowed out, let's take a look at some of the other names in the Republican clown car that you mentioned here. And one that you didn't, although when you say Republican elites, I'm sure Mitt Romney comes to mind for most people. So he trotted out and did his whole Judge Smales routine that kind of reminded a lot of us of why we didn't vote for him in the first place, why I voted for the Constitution Party and a lot of other folks didn't vote for him. Again, not exactly somebody who inspires people with a positive forward message. And again, him trotting out there and doing that, I said it at the time. I was laughing. I said, man, this is almost an in-kind contribution to Donald Trump.
Did you have
that little self-awareness that he didn't see the effect of what he was going to do?
You know, I think it's just very common for people in general to live in sort of bubbles, right? When you're only around other people like you who share your opinions. I mean, we all tend to do that. When you're extremely wealthy, it's a lot easier to do that, right? Because your wealth can insulate you from kind of what other people are thinking. You're just not around normal people anymore. And I think a lot of the Republican elite had no earthly idea that anything like this was waiting out there. To me, this was a bomb that the fuse got lit on a long time ago. But I think a lot of them had no real clue that this kind of resentment against them. I mean, if you look at the votes that have been cast so far, these so-called outsider candidates, Carson, Cruz, Trump, have gotten something like 80% of all the votes cast in the Republican primary so far. So, Romney stands up there and talks at Trump, that to me is he is just embodying everything his supporters hate about, you know, the establishment that they feel has been ignoring them.
Exactly. Plus, this is a guy who groveled for his endorsement 4 years ago, so people see right through that. Mitt Romney, a guy who, again, you know, likes to claim that he's not out of touch here, but, I mean, by his definition, that's talking to his servant Jeeves and talking to his personal assistant, Mr. Smithers. I don't think there's any common touch beyond, you know, those two guys right there. Somebody else you mentioned, Marco Rubio. What's interesting is, again, I'm hesitant to say this because I feel I get accused of putting myself over a little bit too much. But, 4 years ago, you know, he gives the speech at the Republican convention, and I was getting some early looks at the guy going, I just don't get it. He gives a nice speech, but it's all platitudes. And if you just look at it, I'm very sensitive to that, Colin. I'm very sensitive to when people are doing bumper sticker talk, you know, the whole bumper sticker thing here. He did it and never really seemed to go beyond that. And you look at this cycle here, it ended up being the Jackie Gleason hummina thing whenever anybody would get asked what his accomplishments were. You remember Rick Santorum? I thought Rick Santorum would probably prefer to get waterboarded than to have to answer any more questions about, well, what is it about Marco Rubio that impresses you so much? So,
That's a tendency among political reporters.
Yeah, it's like I would like to think this guy is done after this thing for good because, again, I don't appreciate his very primitive foreign policy views here. Am I being an optimist thinking that this guy has been exposed as an empty suit once and for all permanently?
Well, permanently is a long time. I'm sure he's racked up some shit with, you know, I don't even know what the Republican establishment is, the big donors, who knows. But simply by, you know, staying in and trying to hold the flag, I think he's probably gotten some long-term goodwill. But that's a total guess. To me, he always looked like a kid. I was never able to take him seriously. And that's just a person. He is younger than I am, but, you know, not by much. But so is Cruz. But Rubio, I just never could quite take seriously. And I agree with you completely on the platitudes question. He just strings these words together, and you're like, what does that even mean? I interrupted you a minute ago, but I was getting at, you asked about Santorum being asked about Rubio. That's one reason I cannot watch cable news. I simply can't do it because they fill the air with that kind of drivel, you know? Like, why don't you ask Santorum what he believes in and what he stands for? rather than get him to comment on your horse race coverage, which is frankly bogus, you know, personal impressions anyway.
Right. That's a very good point. And again, I think you and I are people who are very sensitive to when we're listening to politicians speak. Again, the whole platitudes, bumper sticker kind of thing here. Again, that's something that Rubio does, and it's something that he has in common with his fellow first-term Cuban-American Senator, Ted Cruz, who is running also at this point. And it's kind of, I mean, and I'll tell you what, I mean this half seriously. I am somebody who has gotten caught up in the whole fervor myself. I'm about halfway through, as it stands right now, House of Cards, really enjoying this season of it. Don't know if you've gotten a chance to do that yet, but no spoilers, please. But you're not in that right now? Okay. I can understand it with the busy campaign season and all, but I can't help but think that anybody watching that is just going to have the obvious connections coming across between Frank Underwood and Ted Cruz. You know, I mean, they try to make a virtue out of the thing, of the fact that everybody hates the guy who knows him. Everybody in Congress, his ex-roommate has racked up a lot of follows on Twitter because he rips him every chance he gets. I mean, Ted Cruz being such a dick, that's a thing where they try to make it like, well, he wouldn't be hated if he wasn't standing up to people. But it's a thing where, like, well, sometimes people are just hated again because they're an a-hole. And it strikes me that that's been the single biggest thing that's been keeping people from coalescing around him. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to who have the same visceral reaction to seeing his unctuous mug on their TV screen talking in that faux folksy kind of a manner that he does. I mean, do you think that he would have more people coalescing around him as the anti-Trump if it wasn't for the fact that he just is so intolerable to so many people in terms of how he comes across, that punchable face of his?
I think you're right on. And you know, if he didn't seem so pious and smug about everything, it'd be one thing. But, you know, don't tell me how morally, you know, how you're going to be morally superior as president when you turn out to be a backstabbing little weasel, right?
Right.
I mean, that stuff with Ben Carson right before Iowa, I think that actually probably hurt him quite a bit because that went to a narrative of him being nasty, right? And you know, there's this old rule that I've read about, you know, here and there, but that, you know, one-liners and zingers and, you know, things like that stick to a candidate when they hit the mark. And Trump is brilliant at that. He's a classic bully. When he calls Bush low energy, it sticks because it's true. When he calls Cruz a nasty guy, that sticks because it reinforces a feeling we already have about him. You know, if I'm a Republican, you know, I don't know what to do. If I were you, I'd be voting Constitution Party again, right? Because
you got it.
You know, neither of these guys is, you know, you talked earlier about you don't want you know, censorship on speech, and I'm with you 100%. I am as much of a free speech purist as you're going to find, and you know, I hate this modern, you know, what's going on the college campuses with political correctness, where they're like not allowing certain speakers to speak, and that offends me to the core. But I'm a big fan of self-censorship, of not saying everything that comes to mind, of having a certain amount of dignity in life. I don't always live up to it. And so I think Trump, anyone who feels that way, I think Trump is just going to turn away completely.
That's a very good point. And that's one of those things, too, where For as much as Trump likes to make a virtue out of being against PC, again, listen, I'm for that writ large. I believe in that. But the thing that's kind of occurred to me over the years is that, again, from my perspective, everything was me stemming from being a social conservative and everything like that comes from being a Roman Catholic. And it gets to a thing of where we all have our reasons, whatever they may be. But in my case, it's like, I don't know, would God really like you saying such and such about all these kind of people? So I could be mistaken at this point for being politically correct because I don't say some of the things and some of the ways that I might have used to say about people. But it's just, I think we all kind of come to that point of reflection whether it comes from religion, whether it comes from something else. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, should you really be doing this, saying this? You should have the right to, but I think most of us with any kind of decency at some point start to question whether we should say things like that.
Yeah, no, I think you bring up a very good point by talking about your own personal faith, because, you know, the way Donald Trump is acting is profoundly unchristian, you know? And
yes.
I think that a lot of people of faith, that will end up being, you know, determinative in a way. Now, I personally feel that Ted Cruz's policy ideas are not very Christian, but that is a debate of a very different kind. With Trump, I think it goes to, and I personally am not a Christian, though I was raised one, but with Trump, I think it goes to a much, it's more of a sense of who he is as a person, that there's a cruelty in him.
There's it's obvious. Again, I don't want to sit here and psychoanalyze anybody that I don't know, but as far as people having a hole in them, whatever, feeding the hole, that seems to be a big part of pop psychology in the last couple of years, and you hear people who've been through rehab and whatever talking about that. My God, the man is compensating for a lot of things here, and for as much as he might have said in the one debate about, oh, no problem with what my hand size correlates to, I don't know. Just pop psychology 101 says that's the most obvious probable indicator, isn't it? I mean, if the man is not overcompensating for a small crank, I don't know what we move down the list to. He's overcompensating for something. We know this, right?
Yeah.
Is not how a secure man conducts himself, Colin Delaney.
Well, I do agree with you, but I will say that, you know, something that I figured out pretty quickly in politics, partly driven by people I knew in college, but partly, you know, driven by actually working, you know, in the Texas legislature way back in the day, that, you know, kind of successful male politicians are sort of driven by, and not all of them, of course, but many of them are driven by this, like, this combination of ego and insecurity, that they're insecure enough to really need the approval of the masses, but they're arrogant enough to believe that they deserve it. And to me, Bill Clinton is a classic example of that combination. I think women's politicians, you know, don't fit that type quite as much. And certainly, again, not every male politician does, but a whole lot do. With Trump in particular, no, I'm not going to try psychoanalyze him either. I've never spoken to that. You know, wealth does weird things to people too, you know.
Oh, it does. It absolutely does. But again, as he is showing, all the money in the world can't buy you that kind of sense of self, that kind of security to where you don't need to demean other people. The man is a lot more insecure, as much as he tries to hide it, than are most people, because he wouldn't conduct himself clearly if he wasn't. One name that we haven't mentioned thus far, probably the last one before we turn our attention to the Democrats, not that he is deserving of any more attention than this, because he's probably going to go down as the pathetic footnote that he appears to be at the moment. My home state governor, John Kasich, angling pathetically to try to stay relevant with a win in Ohio, which present polls show could happen potentially. But again, you wonder about what the end game is. He's been very loud and dismissive of the notion of being anybody's vice president. Mm-hmm. When, again, it would look like with Trump's strength that he has had with blue-collar voters, white voters, et cetera, that you could see Trump going for a strategy of doubling down on the Rust Belt that Kasich might fit into, but he seems to be disavowing that. I can tell you the Ohio Republican Party has been pretty nasty to Trump throughout this thing, which would seem to poison the water even more, but
yeah.
What do you think the end game is there? Is this just, you know, another one of these idiot politicians that looks in the mirror and sees Abraham Lincoln?
Possible. You clearly don't much care for Kasich. I mean, I just remember
from
the Clinton I just remember him from the Clinton impeachment days, really. But you know, in this at the moment, it's to his advantage to stick around, because he might stumble out of a brokered convention president. You know, you never know. I do want to talk about your guy Rand Paul, though, because
yeah,
I was really surprised at how that one turned out. You know, that I really did expect him to fire up a certain segment of the right. I know the terrorist attacks did not help his non-intervention status, or non-intervention, you know, sort of stance. But,
sure.
You know, it's weird to me. It kind of seems like his father did not support him like he could. His father was still appearing in these weird cable gold bug ads predicting an economic collapse last October, like complete economic collapse, so buy gold coins now. And, you know, I wouldn't be doing that if my son were running for president.
No, that's a good point. And in that limited way, I agree. I don't think he was supportive because you should put your own enterprises on hold if that's going to be the case. Now, why he wasn't out there more loud and proud publicly, I think he was
right.
Just doing what they wanted because, again, this is supposed to be Paul 2.0, the mainstreaming of the movement, which, as I've bemoaned before, a lot of the Paul people, again, a lot of the supporters are just quite frankly idiots. And, ooh, he's setting out. He's not realizing that you have to get elected to actually implement these things. So that's
sure.
Part of it is at the base of Rand Paul people or of Ron Paul people, you know, I knew a lot of them were idiots. I was hoping that it wasn't as many as it proved to be. But, yeah, there's a lot of them that did. There's another thing, too, and I'll tell you how bitter I am about this. You talk about somebody being a shapeshifter. Ted Cruz goes from correctly throwing around the term neocon in Iowa like an epithet, which to me it is, to in South Carolina, oh, I think John Bolton would be my ideal Secretary of State.
Oh, God.
I mean, I had a friend who took a Ted Paul or a Ted Freudian slip as much as he tried to beat Ted Paul in Iowa. How's that for a Freudian slip? That's what he wanted people to think in Iowa. I had a friend who took a Ted Cruz policy test online to see how many things that he agreed with, and it turned out to be 97%. And I said, really? How do we define his foreign policy? How do you go from neocon in Iowa to John Bolton would be a great Secretary of State in South Carolina? You talk about shape-shifting.
Yeah.
So Rand was – he was plucked off by Ted Cruz, quite frankly, still there. I think there may have been some voters who just couldn't shake their attachment to Ben Carson, who inexplicably finished ahead of him in the polls. Ben Carson I knew was going to be a spoiler by the time he came back to Earth, and he did. But I'll tell you what, again – you and I are fascinated by the X's and O's of these things, and I still haven't gotten an answer of what happened in Iowa because you were probably looking at it anticipating, as was I. Rand Paul was the only guy out there colonizing the college campuses on the Republican side, working at it hard, 10,000 people mobilized, whatever. I don't know, but it's one of those things where when he dropped out, he kind of made it clear. It was like, look, we were supposed to do better than 5%. We thought that we were doing better than the polls. We did exactly what the polls indicated, and that was our sign. So I still haven't gotten an answer as to what happened there.
Well, one thing is that Cruz had put a lot of time into Iowa, but also
yes.
from a data point of view, like they really knew who their people were. That's one thing I talked about, the Obama style of campaigning. Ted Cruz, of the candidates on the right, seems to have taken the sort of data-driven campaigning model really to heart.
Yes.
But and I think that helped him in Iowa. You know, I'll tell you what, anybody who relies on young voters had better check their strategy because they failed everyone. They failed McGovern in 72. You know, they're not particularly helping Bernie right now. They're not turning out in very high numbers. Those who do tend to support Bernie by a huge margin. But it's just, young people have a lot else on their minds, and they don't vote at a very high rate.
Well, here's the thing. This is a very good point of pivot to the Democratic side, a good transitional question, because this is going to be kind of half and half here. But I've seen a theory out there, and I kind of believe it, and it might seem far-fetched to guys like me and you who are kind of, you know, inside the bubble in a lot of ways, and, you know, we're very fixed in what we believe. We know what we believe. But that there's a lot of potential crossover among young voters with Rand Paul and with Bernie. And that with Bernie being in the race,
sure.
a spirited Democratic race on the other side, I mean, to me, again, I'm a Rand Paul guy. You would be much more for Bernie than for Rand Paul. So it may seem ridiculous to us, right? What would make us shift from one extreme seemingly to the other? But young voters, I think, are lumping them in together as just amorphous change agents. A lot of them, I think, got more excited by Bernie, and I think that cut into the youth thing for Rand Paul.
It's certainly possible. I mean, look, let's face it. Conservatism is not terribly popular on college campuses. If you want to go meet chicks, go to a Bernie rally. You know, I mean, it's that simple. I'm exaggerating slightly. But, you know, there's the old line that the far left and the far right do meet. One thing, yeah. You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, you called them idiots. I'll call them purists. You know, they both, at the ideological ends, you tend to fragment into subgroups, you know, from Monty Python's Life of Brian, you know, when they're in the Colosseum with the People's Front for the Liberation of Judea here and the People's Judean Liberation Front over there. Right. I mean, I think that just naturally happens. With the kids, though, I mean, Gloria Steinem got in a lot of trouble for saying that the girls are going to Bernie events because that's where the boys are. But I'll argue that both of them are going because that's where people are. So that is a little bit of it. But they're also just even, I mean, he's getting very high percentages among them, but they're not turning out at a high enough rate. You know, his difference in Michigan was largely because he got a higher percentage of black voters in Michigan. I suspect because of the, you know, the old industrial, the labor, the hatred of trade pacts. And, you know, Clinton's husband put in NAFTA. And, you know, I would argue that NASA has been a tiny factor in the job losses, but it is an article of faith, you know, in the labor movements in the Rust Belt that NASA, you know, killed their industries. And Bernie really appealed to that. But yeah, kids just don't turn out at a high enough rate. Perhaps one day that'll change.
It may. And again, it fluctuates because, like you said, it doesn't happen very often, but Obama had a higher success rate than do most, and that was definitely part of his advantage in 2008.
It was
so
part of it.
It is sort of like chasing the unicorn, but you see the examples of where it happens, and it makes you think that it's possible. I have to tell you, in the aftermath of Michigan, this is a funny story from inside the FDH Lounge family. And fellow FDH Lounge dignitary Kyle Ross, with whom I co-host a lot of my football and wrestling segments, he's a big Bernie partisan. So and a lot of his friends were part of the lynch mob on the 538 thread the other night. I don't know if you heard about this, but Nate Silver and everybody was getting roasted for their 99% prediction on Hillary winning, which after all was only based off of the polls. So, you know, I'm not sure exactly what 538 was supposed to say at the time. They were having a little bit of, you know, just gloating at their expense. But again, I have a little bit of sympathy for Nate Silver and company on one, because it is, I've seen it called, you know, maybe the biggest upset in primary history, to go from an average of 21.4 down to winning by about 2%.
Yeah, but that's putting too much faith in polls. And here's what the problem was. Michigan tried to jump the rules in 08 and hold their primary early, and the Democratic Party basically took the delegates away. Obama didn't even get
the
ballot. Yeah, so there was no polling in 08. So, and then, you know, with then you only have Kerry Bush, Kerry Gore. You have 2012, you know, you've got midterm, but midterms aren't so relevant. You know, when you're trying to predict a Democratic primary, which is a very special thing, you need data from other Democratic primaries, and they didn't have it. So to me, it's not an upset. It's just the data set wasn't adequate. So anyone who was trying to predict based off it was making a mistake.
Well, here's the thing, too. I will say this, as far as that debate that happened right before the primary that everybody thought was not a disaster for Bernie Sanders, but worked against him. First of all, again, I have no sympathy from my perch, because identity politics is a big part of the Democratic side here. So, but of course I thought it was funny. Of course I sympathize with my friend Kyle Ross's frustration at how Bernie Sanders was being regarded and standing up for himself here. It really is one of these kind of interesting things about modern feminism, which was predicated on, hey, don't treat me like I'm a fragile little doll here. And then, like, the minute that you think somebody is clearing their throat a little bit too much at your expense, you go the other way of like, hey, that's ungentlemanly, that's unseemly. So, like I said, I don't personally have any sympathy for Bernie Sanders, since he's part of that whole culture schmog on that side. But it is kind of funny to look at, is it not?
Well, I'll tell you what. I have a lot of women friends, and a lot of things that I think aren't a big deal turn out to be. So I'm going to stay out of that fight. I'm going to let the women decide when a man is talking to the women. I'm going to let them handle that.
So Bernie hasn't won himself any favors with a lot of groups. You know, I was in the crowd at NetRoots Nations when the Black Lives Matter folks took over the stage last summer, and Bernie really epically failed, you know, screwed up his chance to engage them, right? He blew it in front of a big room. He's a little tone deaf. You know, he is a 73-year-old man who's been, or however old, who's been in Congress for a long time. So, and I do think that the, you know, the not everyone sits and watches the debates with the same eyes a reporter does, you know. So I don't want to put too much on any one Democratic debate or any one Republican debate.
Sure.
Although the Republican debates are so much more a piece of performance theater, I do think they matter more. and a lot more people
right.
are watching. Although it turns out that a lot of the people watching the Republican debates are one, the reason the viewership is up so much is that a lot of Democrats are watching.
Right.
And,
that's part of it as well.
At first, it was to laugh at it. Now it's to be a little afraid.
Oh,
I mean,
exactly.
I'll tell you something about
as they see the big turnout on the Republican side. That's a great point. As far as
no,
it goes with Bernie Sanders again.
No, it's because they think these guys are insane.
What are they afraid of?
They think these people are insane. Trump genuinely scares people. I mean,
I can understand that.
He is the kind of guy who encourages his followers to rough up the crowd. He plays on one group in society's resentment against another. The guy being escorted out by the cops the other day got sucker punched as he was being escorted. Did the cops grab the guy who punched him? No, they threw him out. You know?
Right.
I don't toss around comparisons idly. I have a history degree, and I know a lot about, you know, European pre-World War II history. He feels a lot like Mussolini. He really does. Trump scares the – I was about to say a phrase I can't say on the radio, but he scares the hell out of me. And you know, I'm scared of him as a potential nominee because, like, somebody like Cruz I think would beat handily. Trump is a wild card. You never know what's going to happen.
Well, as far as his likely Democratic opponent in the fall, Hillary Clinton, who we haven't talked much mm-hmm. about here, it's interesting that in this year, and again, I was only a history minor, but I'm fascinated by it myself. For the parallels that people have been throwing around, 1948 as far as party splintering, 1968 as far as the chaos, and hey, at this convention, I mean, imagine if Trump doesn't get the nomination. I am fearful living here in Cleveland. I hope to catch up with you sometime that week, but aside from that, I'm fearful of what the week might be as far as health and home and everything like that that we all cherish here on America's North Coast if Trump turns his mobs loose, if he gets denied. So could be some 1968. I'm looking at Hillary, and I'm seeing a lot of 1988. And I wonder if any of this makes sense to you in the sense uh-huh. of, for all the people who are really afraid on the Republicans, that, oh, what if Hillary wins? I say, you know what? I look at her, and I see, and not policy-wise, not whatever, but as far as, like, how good she is as a politician, a lot of George H.W. Bush. Okay? She may limp in there just because everybody else kind of crumbles and falls apart, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But this has got, like, Madam One Term written all over her, I think. She admitted herself the other day. She was trying to make a virtue out of her. Like, I'm not a natural politician like Obama and my husband. You know, that's not generally something that you admit from a point of strength, right? So
right.
I'm seeing her as somebody who, again, I didn't expect her to be in this much trouble this time around. 2008, especially in retrospect, you could kind of see it coming. She may win the nomination. She may win in the fall, but I'm not exactly sure why anybody long-term should be afraid of her in the way that they were of Obama.
Well, let's see how they govern, how she governs,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, yeah. like I believe that her reelection will be a verdict on how well she governed.
Mm-hmm.
I think the contest with Bernie, I have welcomed this fight with Bernie. It makes her a far better candidate and gets far more people involved. She is not a natural candidate. And believe me, there are plenty of things that I do not look forward to in a Clinton presidency. I don't like a lot of this. You always hear about the Clinton camp. I don't want an entourage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We don't want an imperial court out there. But,
right.
you know, if she's a reasonably successful president, you know, the Democratic coalition is only growing, right? I think the percentage of minority voters
increases by about 2% every presidential year. Now, of course, not all of them are Democrats, but they skew Democratic. And so demographically, the Democrats are in a slightly better position in 2020 than we are now. One thing is, though, that 2020 is the most important election coming up for a long time, because the parties that control – the party that controls the governorships and state legislatures redraws the district lines. And every political professional in the business knows that that is the single most important act in politics. The reason that, for instance, you know, Pennsylvania is a slightly blue state, but its congressional delegation is like three-quarters or two-thirds Republican. That's because of the way the lines are drawn. And so the fight in – there are – I know – I'm sure there are groups on the right as well. There are groups on the left that are have been planning for a year for 2020, right? That 2020 is, you know, regardless of Hillary, it's going to be an epic battle either way. I don't know if she wins. You know, I think you H.W. Bush is not a, you know, not a bad comparison. Of course, it's a very different country right now, different dynamics on all sides. You know, Hillary is not going to have to make the equivalent of a no new taxes pledge, right? There isn't a similar kind of single thing on the left that they could get her on. It'd be like the only equivalent would be her saying, "Oh, I'm against abortion," right? Which she's not.
Right.
So, yeah.
Not at all.
I think that, that she's safer from a revolt on the left than George H.W. Bush was from a revolt on the right. But who the heck knows? You know, a lot happens in 4 years.
That's an interesting distinction, and I can tell you, as far as redistricting goes, again, from my perch in Ohio, as someone who is at least a registered R, I'm saying this, it's an atrocity here. I think it's 12-4 Republican, but the way they had to do it, I'm here in the suburbs on the west side of Cleveland, okay? We got a congressional district that, no lie, stretches out about 5 yards from Lake Erie just so that they could connect it to Toledo. Marcy Kaptur, who the next time she sets foot in Cleveland will probably be the first, is my congresswoman, who's been, again, just mostly associated with Toledo through the course of her career. But they gerrymandered it to get the safe seats for the Republicans and, again, disgraceful. In our moment or so remaining here, quick prediction here toward the end of the primary season. Do you think Trump gets over the hump to get the delegates before Cleveland to clinch it on the first ballot? I think we would both say it's Hillary on the other side right now, but I'm guessing that he does, but I wouldn't think it's a sure thing. What do you think?
You know, 2 weeks ago I would have said I think he'll do it. Now I would give it closer to 50-50. Cruz may be able to galvanize enough to keep him from getting a pure majority. But all these winner-take-all states are up. You know, that was supposed to protect the establishment frontrunner. That may well be enough to put Trump over the top.
It may be. And, again, I'm rooting for your scenario. I want chaos at this point. I want a very, very interesting convention that it'll be the first one that I've ever been on the ground for myself. Somewhere throughout the course of the week, if we don't record anything before then, I certainly hope to get to that week with you, but we'll see how it goes. But again, always a pleasure having you on, my man, the great Colin Delaney, editor of epolitics.com. Thanks, buddy. Keep up the good work, and we'll talk again as this thing materializes.
Thank you so much for having me. I truly enjoyed it.
I always enjoy it myself, buddy, and I always get great feedback about it. Thank you so much for being on. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in today to FDH Lounge Mini Episode number 705.
Trudging around a drafty warehouse, looking for flat-pack furniture, consoled only by hot dogs this weekend? Try the Nissan Red Tag event instead, from the 11th to the 15th of March only. It features huge extra deposit contributions on our crossovers and selected city cars, like £2,000 on a Qashqai at 4.99% APR representative, plus up to 2 years free servicing. Nissan, innovation that excites. Nissan Finance, 4.99% APR representative, subject to status over 18s. T&Cs at nissan.co.uk.